Welcome to Friday. Thanks for tuning in. This is the Week in Review on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke, and with me today we've got Sydney Brownstone, reporter at The Stranger, co-host of the Trust Issues podcast. Hiya, Sydney.
Hi.
Monica Guzman, co-founder, editor of The Evergrey, theevergrey.com, helping Seattleites make the most of their city.
Hey, hey.
Thank you for making the most of this next hour. Knut Berger, the Mossback, columnist for Crosscut and Seattle Magazine. Great to see you, Knut.
Good to see you, Bill.
Thanks for coming. A federal judge just this morning has just temporarily blocked the University of Washington from charging a $17,000 security fee for a UW College Republicans event tomorrow. The judge said the school can charge the fee afterward, but not before. Here's the backstory. UW College Republicans invited a right-wing group, some call them alt-light, Patriot Prayer is the group. They've rallied in Seattle. They want to rally tomorrow at Red Square. And the university said, okay, but there are outside groups that will come and instigate violence. We've got to have police there. That's expensive. It'll cost you a security fee of $17,000. That's much more than the U has ever charged a campus group to bring in a speaker. UW College Republicans sued the university saying, we can't afford that fee, so it abridges our constitutional right to free speech. Sydney, does that seem like a fair argument by the UW College Republicans?
Well, a judge viewed it as fair, right, because they issued a temporary injunction.
They could collect the fee afterward, right?
Right. I mean, I don't think this is a good faith argument about freedom of expression. I think it's a well-crafted publicity stunt to allow racist ideologies on campus.
What would be the point of the publicity?
Well, as we've discussed on this program before, when you have events from these hard right speakers, and they generate a lot of backlash, that can often create sympathy for them. And that's a tactic that white nationalists have been organizing around for the better part of a century. So that's nothing new. And I think that this entire debate about freedom of speech really kind of underlines a vulnerability in our constitutional principles. And it's really tough. It's kind of a catch-22, right? Because freedom of speech protects even the most horrible, ugly speech. And it also gives rise to these events that can create sympathy for people who espouse racist ideologies.
Knut, did the university make the right decision in even allowing this and charging a $17,000 security fee?
Well, the university has staked out a position that they want to be sort of absolutist on free speech. I mean, I asked them in the wake of the kind of catastrophic event when they had Milo Yiannopoulos speak at the University of Washington. There was violence. Somebody was shot. You know, it was a ruckus. And, you know, I asked the president of the UW and the president of Washington State University whether or not they should be able to control who comes on campus. In other words, should these groups be allowed to invite these types of speakers? Aren't there even academic standards that could apply to the kind of program that's allowed on campus? And they said, absolutely not. We're devoted to free speech. We need to be bent over backwards. I think as long as the universities are taking that position, the onus is on them to ensure the safest possible environment for the students on campus. So I think it's on them to pay for the security and provide the security. I think it's another discussion to say whether groups like this should be able to invite, you know, what the standards are. And I go back and I talked about this, you know, in 1934, the German consul was going around to universities preaching and doing PR for Hitler. And the president of Washington State University said, no, you can't come here and speak. So in 1934, you know, someone was out front, you know, saying, we won't allow Nazi ideology on our campus. There was no big uproar about that, although that action was pretty unusual. So, you know, projecting forward, is that something universities, public universities, should or could do now? And I think that is, you know, up for debate.
Monica Guzman, what do you think?
I think this is just a really good example of how volatile things have become just in society in general. College campuses are this microcosm of different ideas and debates. And of course, part of their role in our society is to celebrate and host the free exchange of ideas. And with all of these these related issues coming up really across the country, we're realizing how difficult that has become, that somebody does need to draw a line, right, between ideas that may be different but somehow feel safe and ideas that no longer feel safe. Who gets to draw that line? And then who gets to make the decisions? In this case with the University of Washington, my understanding is that there's no requirement of transparency from the university when it comes to setting the fee. So exactly how do they calculate what the security needs will be? Apparently it's based on some sort of estimate of how dangerous things will become. How do you decide that? I believe
that is their job to estimate,
right,
so that they can align their security forces.
Right. But because these are volatile times and because the lines between what, you know, ideas that feel right to share and ideas that don't feel right to share are sort of up for debate and volatile in and of themselves, I feel like it's on UW to try to lead in trying to get people to some transparent discussion about what's even behind these decisions.
So where does that bring you on whether the UW should charge a $17,000 fee if they say this is why, this is what it costs, and should the UW even allow the Patriot Prayer Group onto its campus? It's not the Hitler 1934 example, but we're on a continuum. What do you say?
Yeah, right now it feels like there's too much darkness around the decision. If there were more light around it, more discussion about what was behind it, then maybe. But right now, it's easy for folks to assume certain attitudes and assertions behind the decision and wonder if the tables were turned, if politics was different, if another group was, you know, could be deemed controversial and some college could levy a fee of its own choosing. You know, if it wasn't for this group, if it was for another group, would some of us feel as okay?
Sydney, I have just named you the president of the University of Washington. Do you allow the Patriot Group rally to go on Saturday?
I think I would, and then I would announce that I am ignoring it, and I would urge all my student body and all my faculty to ignore it and pretend it isn't there. I mean, as a reporter myself, I'm very sensitive to issues surrounding our First Amendment rights, and I think those rights have been challenged by this presidency unlike I've ever seen in my lifetime, right? So I'm hesitant to go out on a limb and say this should not happen, because I think that in some ways, that's what provocateurs like Milo Yiannopoulos and college Republicans who have made themselves in his image want, right? They want some sort of opposition that they can rail against and then claim that they are victims of persecution or oppression. That works very, very well for them, as we've seen over the last couple of years. I think that just because freedom of speech gives them a right to speak doesn't mean that we have to listen.
Mm-hmm. Well, one problem here is that these are not abstract fears for some people. For example, my understanding is that there's a Black History Month event that was also scheduled tomorrow on the UW campus, and that's been canceled. So, and I guess they didn't have to cancel it, but
it was due to this event.
Well, I can't promise that, but it's understandable. The university president, Anna Marie Causey, before I appointed Sydney president of the university, Anna Marie Causey wrote an email this morning that I got, and it said that UW police have obtained credible information that groups from outside the UW community are planning to join the event with the intent to instigate violence. And President Causey said, "I encourage you to avoid Red Square and the surrounding area to ensure your own personal safety." Mm. So you can certainly understand somebody who's like, it's not just a free speech abstract argument, but is it fair to people who feel who can't do what they want to do on campus because of a rally like this?
It is deeply unfair. It is deeply unfair. And the other thing is, this is a pattern that has repeated itself at Evergreen University or Evergreen State College. My apologies. For example, after that whole kerfuffle around race and the biology professor who went on Fox News and, shed his tears, white nationalists came to campus and threatened Black professors, and several Black professors have left as a result. These are tenured academics. These are not, just campus protesters who maybe phrase some things in a way that isn't totally thoughtful. These are people who have had to leave their livelihoods. So I don't know, if again, taking the role of UW president, if I can do that, I would try and find a better venue for the Black History Month celebration. I would try to find somewhere more public and more central. I would try and get the city on board with it. Can that event be relocated to City Hall? Can it be in Westlake Park? Can we get these permits? You know, let's try and counter hate speech with something that's way better.
I have one more question about the specific group, because we've just been talking barely about them, the Patriot Prayer Group. They've rallied in Seattle. Joey Gibson got up there, invited Black Lives Matter activists and other people who disagreed with him up on stage, said, I'll use the more polite language. He said, screw white supremacists, screw neo-Nazis. I have no use for that kind of thinking. It's wrong. And I realize that there's the gaslighting argument, you know, that that's a phony tactic. But does it matter where you place the awfulness of the speaking group when you decide whether to put them on campus, separate from whether it's going to get violent or not? Mm-hmm. You know, this guy professes to be about free speech and dissenting points of view.
Mm-hmm. Well, if he really wants to, you know, have his opinions spoken, he should also be equally open to criticism, right? Because that's also freedom of speech. And I think that as journalists and commentators or anyone watching this happen, we should interrogate the college Republicans. What is the intellectual value of bringing this person to campus? If this is the marketplace of ideas, if his ideas are really worth sharing, what are their merits? That's a question I think that is worth asking.
Knut, any final thoughts?
Yeah, well, just that I really agree with what Sydney was saying. I mean, part of this is, you know, what kind of response do you have? And if you have groups like Black Bloc anarchists or whatever who are intent on violence, you know, that obviously is a security concern. And I think the university has to deal with that. I don't think putting the onus on in advance on the sponsoring group is fair in terms of free speech. On the other hand, you know, Dave Nywert, who works for the Southern Poverty Law Center and is an expert on the alt-right, was at the Yiannopoulos event. You know, he's written about the fact that the best response to this stuff is either ignoring it or he said one of the most effective counter demonstrations he ever saw against Nazis in Olympia was people came dressed in clown suits and dressed as mimes and simply mocked them.
Yeah.
And the group went away dispirited, you know, because they weren't being taken seriously. I do think there's a way that, you know, there are better responses than violence.
Well, again, the University of Washington president says herself, don't go to the Red Square or the surrounding area tomorrow from 8 o'clock to 5 o'clock. She says it could draw 1,000 people. And the UW president says that police have information that outside groups will join the event with the plan to instigate violence. We'll see how all that goes. We're going to continue here on the Week in Review on KUOW with the case of the, what did someone call it, the West Seattle Tree Mafia?
Mm-hmm. Arboricide, right?
Arboricide, exactly. And Lime Bikes on top of street signs and lots more coming up on the Week in Review. This is the Week in Review on KUOW. You know, we're on Twitter at KUOW. I'm Bill Radke with Knut Berger, Sydney Brownstone, and Monica Guzman. And we have a denouement in the case of the missing trees. Some homeowners in West Seattle had trees cut down, more than 150 publicly owned trees cut down so they could have unobstructed views of Elliott Bay and downtown. You can't do that, actually. You can't do that. Last year, one group of homeowners settled with the city for $440,000. This week, a second group of homeowners settled for $360,000. Total, that's about $5,300 per tree. Monica, does that sound about right?
Well, first of all, let me say that I have just been racking my brain to figure out how did this group of neighbors think, I mean, either they didn't know it was wrong, Or what? They figured no one would notice 150 missing trees. As long as they're the houses nearby, no one else is going to really care. I am still just stuck on what was going through their heads. But then
we tried to interview one of them, and we were this close. I really thought he was going to come on the air. He decided, it makes no sense.
But the other thing is, and you might have to remind me of the number, but how many households was that?
I think that it was the total number of households was about maybe six or eight households.
Right. So we're talking,
this time it was five. I guess there were two or three before.
Right. So we're talking $800,000 split up among those households. So the question is, you know, the city's saying this is a deterrent. You know, now we've sent the message. No one's going to do this again. But I guess one question is it a deterrent? Is it possible that the neighbors are like, yeah, okay, well, you know, my home is worth this much anyway. I'm sort of wondering about that. Is there more that should be done?
What do you think? Is that a deterrent?
Jail.
Jail.
There you go. Well, right to the big.
Actually, they were not criminally charged. The Seattle City Council member, Lisa Herbold, told me this week that it's because the city either couldn't prove or maybe wasn't sure they could prove that it was done knowingly and maliciously.
Well, this is a tactic that these folks use. I mean, not just in this case, but there have been other cases around town. There was the judge who lived in Mount Baker who had an entire hillside clear-cut for his view, and he got in a lot of trouble over that and had to pay a huge fine and restore it. But it took forever. And one of the problems in these cases is they can hire tree cutters who are casual labor. They disappear. Nobody really has a phone number. Mm. You know, they basically do it when no one's looking or people are looking the other way. So it is hard to make a criminal case. The thing is, it's bad on so many levels. I mean, one, it's, you know, destroying public property. It's damaging the environment. The city's trying to increase its tree canopy. And these people also live adjacent to a slope.
Yeah.
In other words, the landslide, these trees are put there, you know, or, you know, allowed to grow there because they'll help prevent that hillside from ending up in Elliott Bay. So it's just all kinds of selfish and dumb.
I talked with, as I say, Councilmember Lisa Herbold about, is that fine big enough to deter the next homeowner? And she said it's more than money.
I think the story isn't just about the settlement and the dollar amount of the settlement. I think it's also about the fact that this story has been in the news for 2 years, and I think there's an important deterrent element from having your name and the names of your neighbors associated with this action.
Which got me wondering whether I should be reading the names. I really waffled on Tuesday when we talked about this, because, and I didn't end up reading, and I heard from some people on Facebook saying, yeah, you're a news show.
Shame.
Read the names. Shame them. And I just thought, is some vigilante going to say, I know that person? I don't know. I mean, it's right. You can read it, and it's probably in The Stranger. I saw in the names in The Times. They're out there.
Oh, yeah, we'll publish anything.
What should we do to these
people? Well, I was thinking, you know, since, I mean, you can't sort of turn them into public outcasts in a city that boasts the Seattle Freeze, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like,
everybody's an outcast.
Yeah, exactly. But it's like you're pre-outcast. Yeah.
I do think this is a symptom, though, beyond the individuals of a bigger problem, and the attitude in the city that you can kind of control things beyond your own backyard. And the New York Times actually published a great piece about this by Emily Badger about how people became NIMBYs, right? How they came to want to control things beyond their own backyard. And she ties it back to the history.
Wait a minute, isn't NIMBY literally controlling something that's only in your backyard?
Well, I mean, you could look at the case of Fort Lawton, for example, where neighbors want to prevent housing development for formerly homeless seniors to go up. You know, so it's not quite, you know, backyard. It's also like just beyond the borders of your backyard, I would argue. But it's a really fascinating piece that kind of looks into how this view was established. Like, how did people come to think that it was okay to eliminate 150 trees just so your view is better? How did people come to think it's okay to oppose public housing in your neighborhood because it would change the neighborhood character? And I think that's that idea and that attitude is really worth interrogating.
Hmm.
One more thing.
Yes.
I just want to give someone named Kelly Antoine a shout out because she wrote a book about the West Seattle tree story, and she titled it based on something I said on KUOW. She heard me call them the West Seattle Tree Mafia, and then, so she wrote a book of fiction about a West Seattle tree cutting mafia.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
There's a part of me that almost wishes we lived in an alternate universe where you could say that part of the consequences for having done this is that you now have to answer questions about how you did it so we can all, you know, understand more deeply how you thought you'd get away with it, the reasons why. And so other neighbors can sort of see their own, oh, gosh, maybe I don't want to do anything like this. Or I've thought like that before, too. Like, you want the story to get out a little more. I want to know what was in their heads. I mean,
yeah.
For example, I noticed in the stories that we're not really even sure when the trees were cut down, just over the span of time. So part of me goes, well, gosh, were they doing like a few trees at a time, hoping that, you know.
Oh,
just, like we don't
creeping,
know.
Creeping clear cut.
So, I mean, that kind of information would be pretty interesting.
There are people who live on that cul-de-sac who didn't participate in the tree cutting, or at least didn't get caught. Wouldn't you like to be a fly on the wall or a fly on the hamburger at the annual block party
exactly.
on the cul-de-sac of 35th Avenue Northwest? Like, is there a homeowner who didn't have to pay but still gets the unobstructed views and they get the moral superiority?
Uh-huh.
Or do they hate each other? Or what's going on there?
Yeah, I'm not at all justifying.
Your kids
these...
have play dates together?
Right. You don't get to go to Jimmy's house anymore.
I'm not at all justifying what these folks did because I think it's really a crime. But it also is kind of ironic that we live in a city that worships trees, but we're on the site of an old growth forest that we cut down.
Yeah, thank you.
You know,
yeah, so, is that wood in your house?
All that, yeah, those little wooden bungalows that I like so much.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Look at those beams. Where did they come from?
Yeah, those beautiful, beautiful beams.
And I think there has long been this kind of warring tension in Seattle between the people who want the little cottage in the woods feel and the people who just, you know, want space.
Yeah.
They want light. They want to let the daylight in, how little of it there is. Mm-hmm. You know?
That's right. That lovely house that really lets in the light, that's because the trees are cut.
That's out. Yeah, exactly. And the view and all that. So there is a kind of living contradiction that we're involved in.
I did get a suggestion from a listener who said Australia had this illegal tree cutting problem and figured out a creative approach.
Perth, Australia, decades ago, had the same problem with cutting down trees in public lands in order to improve views. And what they did at that site was put up a large billboard facing the homes that said trees on this site were vandalized and this billboard will remain until the replacements reach maturity. An idea we might consider.
Wow.
Wow.
That's your view. Enjoy it.
Into it. Yeah.
You have an unobstructed view of a shaming billboard.
Yeah.
This is the Week in Review on KUOW, and we're going to come back and talk about candy-colored bike, shrink-wrapped to a mattress, and more seriously, left in the way of people who can't get around them and what the city ought to do with bike share. And we're going to embrace the gray, too, coming up later on the program. Stay tuned. It's KUOW's Week in Review. Sydney Brownstone from The Stranger, Monica Guzman from The Evergrey, Knute Berger from Crosscut in Seattle Magazine. If you see a brightly colored bicycle on top of a stop sign or shrink wrapped around a mattress up against a tree and someone says, that's a public art project, you might say, ooh, what a searing indictment of convention. But if it's just a vandalized Lime bike, that's an eyesore. There are more than 9,000 Lime bikes and spins and OFOs rolling in our city. Users unlock a bike with an app and they ride it and they leave it in a bike rack, on the sidewalk, in a park, in Lake Union, on top of the Fremont Troll. Here's what Dallas, Texas did this week. The city told their bike share companies, you either remove all your bikes from trails and from narrow sidewalks, or we will impound them. Dallas News columnist Robert Wolanski told me Seattle has 9,000 bikes. Dallas has more than 20,000.
They're just being left everywhere. People want bike share here. There's no doubt about that. They want docked or dockless. And most people treat the bikes well. The problem is they're simply everywhere.
Now, in Seattle, you don't call the city to complain. You could call the bike share company phone number on the bicycle. Knute, do you wish Seattle would get more involved and crack down on bike shares?
No, I don't think it's a problem. I think it's a sign of success, at least so far.
How so?
Well, I think it's making bicycles, the availability of bicycles more ubiquitous. More people are using them. I think when you initiate new programs like this, there should be kind of an amnesty period where you sort of allow these ideas to see if they can take hold. I mean, I always compare like visiting Japan and, going to Japan where they would have these like incredibly beautiful vending machines right on the street corner where you can get all kinds of great things to drink and eat. And in America, these things would be trashed right away.
Yeah.
And we're seeing some signs of that, but we're also seeing a lot of very positive, people are using these things. And it's also, I think, broadening the appeal of biking so you don't feel like you've got to be a cycle racer in special clothes, going out. And
you don't even need a helmet.
You don't even need a helmet.
Crack down on that.
Well,
again, officially you do.
Officially, but I think that's good that we're not. I think it's good that they're not doing that. So I think you just look at these things in phases. I mean, I look at it and sometimes I laugh about where the bikes are or feel sorry for whoever's going to have to climb that tree and get it down. Mm-hmm. But the vast majority are being used and used legitimately and putting in, left in places that aren't outrageous. So, I'd like to see where this experiment goes before we get all Scandinavian about it.
Does anyone here agree with Peter on Facebook who says, I hate them? I really hate them. I see tech bros riding them down the sidewalk with no helmets on and talking on their phones at the same time. Did I mention I hate them?
Peter, how does this affect you? what are you up to? No, I agree with Knut on this one, which means I disagree with Peter. I think that having the bikes out everywhere is a really democratizing way to expand bike share. And something that I've seen from living in other cities when they first roll out bike share programs is it's a kind of an economy of scale problem, right? So they roll them out in very limited areas. And oftentimes those are in the center of cities. So only tourists use them. And then when tourists aren't there, they don't get used. They don't actually get used by the rest of the people in the city. So I think that bike share companies and the city can learn a lot from what's happening and then place their bikes more strategically in the future.
So when I lived in New England, when I lived in Houston, when I lived in Michigan, there were no daily reminders, that maybe I should feel guilty that I'm not riding bikes.
Mm.
In Seattle, there are daily reminders that maybe I should feel guilty that
right.
I do not ride bikes.
The bar is low. This guy's riding a bike.
Because, even moving to Seattle, it was amazing to just feel, that culture. Like here, it's just healthy. It's awesome. Sure, it's hilly, but take that as a challenge. Sure, it's rainy, but take that as a challenge. It's like just one of the things we can be real proud of that even in Seattle, and especially in Seattle, bike culture is like the best. Mm-hmm. And it's just not something I have picked up. And now I'm looking around the city and it's just like, oh, right. I'm still not on this. So that's the only way I can think of it affecting people. It's not maybe the most noble of ways, but there it is.
I don't want to take a position on the policy because, I'm a neutral host, but I use bike share all the time. And, one underappreciated thing about it, because we're talking about it as a transit option and a public planning issue and a public nuisance and everything, but I forgot how much fun riding a bike is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's great. And then you just ride it as far as you need to go and drop it off. I'm responsible about it. And you know what? There was a windstorm where some bikes had fallen down. And I brought my bike up and I laid it down next to the other bikes. Because otherwise, if I leave it up, then it's going to get violently blown down. Mm. It's nicer for the bike. What's so bad about a bike? When did a bike lying down become a problem in people's lives?
A sign of civilization collapse.
Is it really that bad?
No.
Is it really that bad?
I see it as just the opposite. I'm hoping that Seattle needs much better bike infrastructure. I'd like to see us have, an extensive system of grade separated, bike paths and stuff like that. And I think this will help build a constituency for that, even people using it very casually.
Here, there's a real problem. Yesterday, I interviewed someone who's a power chair user. And he says this is a Disabilities Act, American Disabilities Act problem. If you can't get where you're going, then it's not just a matter of, oh, isn't that bike adorable that it's on a stop sign?
Mm.
Or, the problem is real for some people. But then the question is how much the city ought to get involved in. In Dallas, it's the Wild West. I mean, Dallas, it's unregulated, but the city is is more they permitted just these three companies. I think
maybe we should make people who cut down public trees pick up the bikes.
There you go.
Oh, that was a good idea.
Recover them.
Bike cleanup.
Yeah, I'm into that.
You
new
have
city
solved
service.
It.
Amazing.
I'll give the last word on bikes to Callan on Facebook, who says regarding the three companies, Spin is best, Lime Bike is fine, Oso is terrible. I think he means Ofo is terrible, but the one you'll see the most, just like life. That's how it goes. And one more little transportation story. I thought of you, especially Knut. That did you see that the Friends of the Benson Trolleys is trying to raise money to bring back these old-timey trolley cars?
Well, they're genuinely old-time, but yeah.
But they're from like the 80s. I mean,
well,
right?
We used to have that great waterfront trolley, which was done as a tourist attraction. It was never like a big piece of infrastructure, but it went away when they did the sculpture park.
Is that old-timey enough to spend $28,000 on? Because you have to retrofit them still. They're not perfect for modern.
I'd love to see them going again. I thought it was. Unfortunately, I'd like to see them going along the waterfront like they used to, because without the viaduct, especially, it's a great way to get from one end of the waterfront to the other. But no, I'm all for it.
I'd ride one with you anyway.
Yeah, they're fun.
Okay, more. In fact, let's talk about we're gonna go from bike share to bike racks set up specifically to discourage people from camping in public areas. And as I say, we're gonna embrace the gray when we come back on the Week in Review. We're in the club on the Week in Review on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke, Knut Berger, Sidney Brownstone, Monica Guzman. We're on Twitter at KUOW. Some of us are dancing. Okay, this week saw another case of so-called hostile architecture. City of Seattle put up fences under some bridges and overpasses to keep people from camping there. The Seattle Times gave the example of $100,000 for fences under the Ballard Bridge and quoted Seattle City Council member Mike O'Brien saying, for that much money, you could have housed five campers for a year. And by the way, those campers didn't move to North Dakota. They're probably three blocks down next to a business. But the city points out it's even more expensive to fight fires and fix damage from the things people do under those bridges. Sydney, who's right?
I think hostile architecture is a deeply cynical strategy to try and, I don't know, keep houseless people exiled from places where they can find shelter temporarily. I don't know how you can compare the value of, you know, trash left under there versus the value of someone, you know, staying out of the rain for a night.
Well, the city says there have been fires under bridges, says wooden structures, open flames, and propane tanks pose a clear danger to public safety with the potential to destroy this critical transportation corridor.
Well, then the problem is lack of housing. The problem isn't the houseless people finding shelter where they can, right? That's kind of a tertiary effect from lack of housing. But I think this story also shows the impact that local reporting can have. And I'm totally biased in saying that, and I will freely acknowledge it because my colleague and my very good friend Heidi Groover first introduced the term hostile architecture.
I thought that was Teresa Mosqueda from the city, but she got that from Heidi Groover?
Yeah. I mean, because Heidi, when she found this story about these bike racks under the bridge, she went to...
This was in Belltown. The city admitted it, right? That they put bike racks up to discourage camping.
Yeah, this is something they freely admitted, that it was something to discourage camping. And so she went to the director of Seattle University's Homeless Rights Advocacy Project, a woman named Sarah Rankin, and she said, you know, what's up with this strategy? And Rankin gave her the term hostile architecture, right? This is something that we've seen all across the world. And in London, we've seen spikes put up to deter people from sleeping on the sidewalk, et cetera. And because that term was introduced, you know, we saw city council members and even SDOT use it and, you know, say that they're not going to adopt that strategy anymore.
Monica, you're nodding, but what's the solution to allow camping where it's currently not allowed?
Yeah, I mean, what gets me about hostile architecture is the dishonesty of it, the sneakiness of it, because, you know, a casual look at those bike racks in Belltown just go, oh, there's bike racks. Cool. And you walk by, right? Something more upfront would be a big sign that says, no camping allowed here by order of la-di-da-di-da. But of course, there is no order because there was no process, because there was no conversation. someone in the city just decided this is what is better for the city.
So it would be less hostile to have a big sign saying no camping here?
It would not be less hostile, but it would be more honest. Hmm. And at least it would have to go through some kind of decision-making process that everyone's aware of, right? Because this is clearly not an easy issue to talk about, right? I'm sure there's a lot of people in the city kind of, you know, nodding their head going, well, good. You know, now I don't have to worry about people camping in those spaces. It's incredibly tricky because, yeah, like Sydney said, like who wants to know, you know, that people are having fewer and fewer spaces to be safe and to just be human beings who are sheltered in whatever ways they can. And there's just such a much bigger problem with the availability and affordability of housing. You kind of can't look at this narrow thing without looking at that big thing, right? And if you think this is a solution, well, okay, we can have that conversation, but let's have that conversation, you know, and not just, oh, just notice the bike racks and ask the question.
But the city is implementing other solutions. I mean, they're working on adding housing units and expanding shelters and 24-hour centers, right? I mean, this isn't the
right, but I don't remember the announcement. Mm-hmm. That's the difference.
Right. Knut, what do you think?
Well, I agree. I mean, I think the whole idea of the hostile architecture, it shows up in all kinds of ways, but I think it's a symptom of the problem that Sydney talked about, which is the city's not moving fast enough. You can say, well, how can they move any faster? I mean, there are things we could have done and could be doing in terms of getting micro housing onto public property. I think getting people sheltered. The interesting thing is there's also kind of a cultural element. I mentioned Japan, you know, and the vending machines on the street corners. I remember seeing homeless people in Japan in cities under viaducts and under bridges. And it was always so tidy. It was like they had these little containers and it was like a bento box, you know, of everything kind of neatly sorted.
Did you know whether that was some municipal program?
No, you know, it was just stuff I saw as I was speeding by on the train and that kind of thing. And so it may be a cultural aspect, or it may be that these places, I mean, there's also positive architecture. Look at what some of the things that have happened at Westlake by not taking away seating, but by adding seating and by adding people who can monitor those spaces in a positive way. I mean, there are ways that you can try and encourage better behavior. And I think that's, you know, that's part of the issue with, you know, open flames and things like that. The other thing is that this hostile architecture, it's just snuck into so many things. And I think about some of the bus stop seating, you know, where they have those little metal grates that are really uncomfortable to sit on. It's like sitting on a cheese grater.
Yes.
You know? And it's obvious they don't want anybody to be there too long or too comfortable, you know, or benches where they make it so you can't lie down or you can't.
They'll put armrests so that they're individual seats instead of one long
exactly.
lie down.
I mean, there's all kinds of ways that architecture is sort of being used to, you know, control what we kind of talk about as, you know, undesirable behavior. And I agree with Monica, too, about let's, you know, make it a more open process. This sort of stealth thing of like, oh, we're going to disguise what we're doing by making it bike racks. Mm. I mean, that's sort of the Seattle passive aggressive.
Oh, well, what about the fences? The fences are quite obvious and literal. You can't go in here.
That's true.
Better?
Yeah, I mean, when you think about it, you know, this may not be a very good solution. There's something to say about it being so elegant and convenient, right? Because in other situations, we've said, well, police presence has to be there when camps need to be swept. You know, we have to spend hours of officials' time. It's like, well, or you can just throw a bike rack and make it completely impossible, and you just, that's it, you're done. So I can imagine that for some in the city, this is easy, and you don't have to make a fuss, and that's it, and everyone moves on. One of my favorite things about Heidi's story is that the whole reason, you know, that she knew about it, right, was because there was a resident in a Belltown condo who noticed the bike racks and did a Freedom of Information Act request, which is, oh, that's amazing, right? So it took a citizen really being alert.
Why did the city even admit to the intent? If you can have bike racks, right? Couldn't it just be a bike rack? Did the city have to, what is there, some internal memo that got that? Some email that got surfaced that proved that this was not a bike rack, wasn't just a bike rack?
Heidi interviewed them. She went to SDOT and she said, why is this here?
Uh-huh.
Because this is what it seems like. And they fully admitted that it was a strategy. Okay. And I mean, clearly they admitted that because they didn't see a problem with it, right?
Yeah, right.
And with regards to your question about fences as opposed to bike racks or spikes or whatever else, I can see the argument for public safety being made for fences, right? Like on some of those spaces near I-5 that people have fallen off before. Mm. I can see, you know, the argument for putting up fences on particularly steep inclines. But I think this is also a contradiction of our publicly stated principles about who is allowed in public spaces or not. How can we profess to be a city that is welcoming of all people and yet put up barriers constantly that exiles people based on their socioeconomic status? It doesn't make any sense to me.
Coming up on the Week in Review, we'll invite you to embrace the gloom, embrace the gray, embrace the guitar-playing billionaire, possibly embrace the sports car orbiting Mars. So please stay with us. You're listening to The Week in Review on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke with Monica Guzman, Knute Berger, and Sydney Brownstone. In my family, if you complain, which I do, someone is likely to ask you, are you doing something about it or are you just whining? I love that about my family. Well, in the Pacific Northwest, we have a lot of clouds and raindrops to whine about. And Monica Guzman, your Evergrey newsletter, is doing something about it with a project called Embrace the Gray. What is it and why do you spell gray with an E?
Well, first things first. So Embrace the Gray is an attempt to, rather than, you know, all go through the motions every single year of dealing with the season sort of by ourselves and venting to each other here and there, is actually to put out the intention, hey, everybody, and the invitation, join this group if you are interested in helping each other take steps to love the gray just a little more. So if you can't stand it, you want to get the heck out of here, you know, hopefully being in this group will just move you to where you can't stand it, but you're good, et cetera, right? Mm, and maybe we can even get you to where you actually appreciate something about this season. So we invited, you know, people who are struggling with just that thing, and we invited people who love the gray into this group. And we said, all right, like, go nuts. And we've introduced some challenges, things people can do. For example, last week we said, all right, everybody, look out the window, and when it's raining, grab your jacket, call a friend, and go take a walk in the rain.
Yeah.
Share the picture. Tell us how it went.
This is the mindfulness idea of act opposite to emotion. That's a thing. Like, the thing you really are avoiding, run at that.
Right, because at the end of the day, like, the Seattle weather is not going to change. I mean, global warming, who knows? But like, for the most part, weather's not going to change. So the only thing we can change is our attitudes. And maybe we can make some happier Seattleites in the process.
Knute, you love you some gray. And is that just, did you come by it naturally? Or did you take some kind of opposite action and, and you know, to learn to embrace
that? Well, I just grew up with it, so it was normal. I remember.
So the next generation won't have this problem.
My kids are pretty much that way too. Although my daughter sometimes has the, you know, light deficiency thing, and she so she goes to California or someplace.
Does she have a device that
soak up some sun.
Shines in her face?
No, I don't think so. But she feels the lack of it sometimes. But I literally just take it as normal. And maybe once or twice at the end of February. Part of it is, like, we have so many different kinds of rain. Mm-hmm. And we should have like 100 words or 1,000 words for rain, right? You know, mm-hmm. And so occasionally I'll go outside and I'll hit that kind of rain that seems like it's just humidity, but by the time you go half a block, you're soaked.
Yeah.
You know, there's got to be a word. And I'll stand there just kind of like, really? You know,
just don't make that word moist, because in the last year I've been told that moist is the least popular word in the English language.
Oh,
totally fine when I was growing up.
Word.
And suddenly we all as a group just turned on the word moist.
I didn't get the memo.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But I lived in California for a couple years and for 1 year I lived like in Palo Alto.
Mm-hmm.
70 degrees and sunny every day. I thought I was going to go insane. I mean,
really?
literally thought I was going to go mad. There was no weather. It's like, where's the wind? Where are the clouds? Where's the Where's the action?
Well, Knut's making it look easy. What, have you had to do anything to embrace the G-R-E-Y? I still want to talk about
that. Oh, yeah,
we
haven't talked about that.
Yeah, I mean, I wish I had Knut's constitution, first of all, because I already struggle with depression and anxiety, and the weather, and especially for long stretches of months, definitely makes it worse. So I've come up with a list of tactics just to kind of break me out of my rut, because I think that, you know, getting into a pattern of isolating yourself and isolating yourself inside does not help that at all. So I actually have taken to pretending I'm living someone else's life by going to hotel lobbies.
Wait. This sounds so insightful.
This is a great idea.
Maybe I shouldn't give this away, and maybe like the people who work in hotel lobbies will become
I'm putting
more...
this in the group immediately.
Hotel detectives.
Seriously, like you can go to the most expensive hotels, and because Seattle's like naturally passive aggressive, they won't say anything to you, and you can just curl up with a book by a roaring fire and pretend you're staying in there for $300 a night, and it really helps me, I'll tell you that.
It's like you're test driving a yacht. You're just like you just go in and you got every right to be there.
Yeah. Please don't put up hostile architecture to deter me from going into these hotel lobbies.
I like the spikes on the leather lounge chairs.
Get Sydney out of here.
So our reporter Anna Sophia Knauf, who's amazing, is doing great work on this project. And after a lot of her interviews, we sort of found that the common denominator really to most ways that people have found to deal with the gray better is just to make plans, just to be intentional. Because if you default to sort of passively living your life, the weather is just going to make you want to stay in a little more, right? Make you want to kind of ho-hum a little more. So it means you have to up your sense of intention and just be more of the planner and, you know, pick up the phone and call your friends more.
But what if those insiders just liked being inside, and that's just fewer people at the museum when I'm trying to go there?
Oh, well, there you go. I guess that's a perk.
Yeah. One thing I dug about your project is that when I see a photo of rainy weather or a video, I think it looks nice. So there's something about putting a frame around it, which is also kind of a metaphor for other things. Like if you just can look at it as, you know, it's just look at it as art. And then it doesn't look so ugly.
Yeah, actually, part of the project is an Instagram challenge that we're going to announce the winner of in next Tuesday's newsletters. But yeah, people have been sending us their greatest pics.
Yes.
G-R-E-Y-T-E.
Okay, now regarding the G-R-E-Y, if I didn't know you, if just in the abstract, I would say spelling theater, R-E, and spelling gray, E-Y, is pretentious. But you seem like one of the least pretentious people I know, so what gives?
Okay, well, there's a couple things. One is that when you think of gray matter, it's spelled with an E, and I like the cerebralness of that.
Why is gray matter spelled with an E?
It just is. I don't know. Like when you talk about gray matter, I almost
Hercule
always see
Poirot,
it with an E. I have no idea.
My column in Seattle Magazine was gray matters with an E for like 5 years, and then we switched to the A. So
you did?
Yeah, we did.
Do we need to have a conversation?
We may need to have a conversation.
We need to talk.
No, really, at the end of the day, it just looks pretty with all the E's. It just looks pretty.
It's three E's instead. That's true. It's not broken up.
It just looks nice.
Because breaking it up is hostile architecture of words.
Exactly.
E A E A E.
Leave those little benches on the E. Those little rungs.
You can't get comfortable.
Climb up.
We asked listeners how they cope with Seattle gray. Cody on our Facebook page says work, books, practicing musical instruments, travel, more books, more work, cannabis. And Amy on Facebook writes, invest in a great wide-brimmed hat, a warm waterproof jacket, and rugged shoes. Get outside. Watch spring awaken. There are cherry blossoms in bloom today on Capitol Hill. How do you feel about cherry blossoms in February?
Yeah, that feels weird.
Yeah, it's the thing. We'll find something to complain about. Thank you, Facebook posters. And finally, just quick billionaire news this week, because you had Elon Musk shooting a car into space, and Vulture ran an interview with Quincy Jones where he said, you know who sings and plays just like Hendrix? Paul Allen. So you can be the judge. Here's a little tasty riffage, courtesy of the 42nd richest person on the planet. This sparked a discussion in our newsroom about whether billionaires can be cool. Are there any cool billionaires?
Oh, boy. Yeah, Paul Allen is like the geekiest billionaire, right? I mean, he's helped fund SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence.
Yeah.
He's behind our science fiction museum, you know, now part of MoPop. He's a pretty geeky guy, but the guitar, that's points.
I tend to think of billionaires like Gollum from Lord of the Rings. Uh-huh. Like, if you've spent enough time around that money, you'd kind of turn into a shrunken shell of a human being. I don't know if anything can change my thoughts on that.
But you like to think it anyway.
Yeah.
That's so puritanical. I think he's having a blast.
Yeah, he's having.
You know, he's got the supervillain yacht. He fills it up with rock stars. They have to listen to him play music. You know.
Yeah.
And he's built a museum devoted to his adolescent obsessions, science fiction and rock music.
Exactly.
You know, it's just, and plus he does, you know, great serious stuff. Plus he won a Super Bowl. You know, I mean, he's my favorite billionaire, I have to say.
But who's cooler? Is Bill Gates not cool because he's doing the malaria thing? Like, is that uncool?
That's worthy.
It's worthy.
It's worthy.
But it's not cool.
But I wouldn't spend my money like Bill Gates. I would spend it more like Paul Allen. Plus, he's, you know, building rocket ships and space vehicles.
Elon Musk hates public transit. Sorry.
Does he? Is that why it's a car that's orbiting and not a bus or a bike share?
Yeah, I don't know. I just had to get that in there.
Okay, maybe we're not ready to move on to Elon Musk, but I have a thought
on
that.
Go think it. We have a minute left.
Okay, because I didn't realize at first when I saw that headline that sports car is not coming back.
Right.
Like, it's out there, and it's circling around. Here's what I'm thinking as a huge fan of science fiction, because my brain goes here. Mm. What the aliens, who eventually are going to come swing by Earth, the thing that they might find first is a sports car.
Yeah.
Like, that's the representation of humanity to space creatures. And I feel like we should have been a part of that decision. What gets out there? What represents us floating around the sun?
Good point.
Like, some billionaire gets to decide what that thing is going to be without my say-so.
Well, I just think it's funny because it's not even the first car we've left in space. We've left three on the moon, built by Boeing. And it's sort of like we're, you know, one of those farms in North Dakota, you know, with just all the resting vehicles in the front yard, right?
Yes. I think that's a Bruce Springsteen album as well. And maybe Jimi Hendrix. That's Knute Berger, the Mossback, Crosscut in Seattle Magazine, Sydney Brownstone at The Stranger, co-host of the Trust Issues podcast, Monica Guzman, co-founder, editor of The Evergrey. She can spell it any way she likes.
TheEvergrey.com.
I'm Bill Radke. Have a great weekend.